All right, it's goddamn Monday morning again. Here I am. It's my show. Welcome to it. Thanks y'all for showing up. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy. Anti-war stuff, mostly. Stop by my website, scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,500 of them now. Going back to 2003. At scotthorton.org. Whole show archives, too, if you want to listen to those. And you can find my blog there, although I admit I don't do much blogging. God dang, I keep meaning to get back into it, but Twitter's just easier. It's so easy to tweet. It's pretty easy to post a WordPress blog, too, but not as easy as tweeting. Oh, well. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. That's where I do most of my complaining. So yeah, man. There you go. Hey, you know what? While you're at scotthorton.org, I meant to say, stop by the chat room. Hey, chat room guys, how's it going? We got a few people in there. Morning. Coming up on the show today, Patrick Coburn. He's the author of The Jihadi's Return. And he will be on the show to talk about The Jihadi's Return. Yeah. He's about as good as it gets when it comes to Western reporters in the Middle East. I'm pretty sure that's true there. So that should be good. And then, I don't know, man. I'm waiting to hear back on a bunch of invites that I got out. You know what? I'm just going to keep calling Reza and Trita at the commercial breaks here, because I really want to talk to them. They're from NIAC, the National Iranian American Council, and they're in Vienna right now. And I want to talk with them. And so, which brings us to the news, and I don't know which one is the biggest. Which is the top headline to you? Rand Paul to introduce declaration of war against the Islamic State. Or Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel forced out by Barack Obama. He resigned this morning. Or the Iran talks have sorta kinda failed again. It was the deadline for the final deal. Eh, they've agreed to put it off. I think that's gonna be our top story starting right now. Iran and U.S. foreign chiefs meet face-to-face before a nuclear deadline. Just Kerry and Javad Zarif. And they still couldn't work it out. And in fact, I believe... I think this is the article that said that they came up with new demands. The Americans came up with new demands this weekend. Just to sabotage the damn thing, which is what Gareth said last week, too. And, of course, the Americans, and especially the Republicans in Congress, are so inflexible on the sanctions that that's pretty much sabotage as it is. I don't see the new demand in this one. Maybe it was in the Reuters piece. Well, the headline is, Iran nuclear talks extended for 7 months. After failing to meet deadlines. So they're going to have some talks in Oman in a month. But they're giving it another more than half a year to come up with a final deal. Except, of course, by then the Republicans will have been sworn into the Senate. And they'll have into the majority leadership again. And they'll be willing to do anything that they can to block this. And anyway... we have had to conclude it's not possible to get an agreement by the deadline that was set for today, and therefore we will extend the talks to June 2015, June 30th, said the British Foreign Minister Philip Hammond. He was referring to the Joint Plan of Action interim deal, yeah. All right, so, you know, I don't know, man. I'm disappointed, but then again, I was only hopeful. I wasn't really... expecting a deal. I just wanted there to be a deal, that's all. it has seemed from time to time like, geez, the president seems to really want this thing for him to work this hard to get this far. But he is Barack Obama, so what else is going to do but fail? He is John Kerry. What else is he going to do but fail? And, yeah, meanwhile, the Israelis over at the Jerusalem Post, exclusive, cornered, but unbound by nuclear pact, Israel reconsiders military action against Iran. No, give me a break. They don't have the ability to do it. All they have the ability to do is start a war that America will have to finish for them. That's what they have the ability to do. Israeli officials cite sunset clause in proposed comprehensive deal, which guarantees Iran a path into the nuclear club and may corner Israel into war. Yeah, Israel will have to start a war on the presumption that Iran's civilian safeguarded nuclear program could one day be a weapons program, huh? And the Iranians are the ones who are the threat to peace. When the Israelis, as we all already know, have hundreds of nuclear weapons, including thermonuclear weapon, H-bombs in the multi-megatons, and including submarines that the Germans gave them that Americans probably paid for somehow or another, which gives them second strike thermonuke capability. Oh yeah, no, it's the Iranians who are the threat. And meanwhile, what's the deal? Just like always, the conservative, the imperial, and including the conservative media, the liberal media, they're just as bad on this usually, but Obama happens to be on the right side of it, so they're less worse than usual, sort of. I mean, the New York Times is still as bad as ever, but the conservatives, the war party, they are dependent on your ignorance. Their entire argument, as always, depends on the premise that you don't know anything about it, that you're learning everything you know about Iran's nuclear program as they're lying to you. Oh no, Obama wants to leave them with the capability to make nuclear weapons. Well, what are you going to do? Spend the next week learning about it? Nah. That's their bet. Their bet is that you're just going to take their word for it. That's why Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, and George W. Bush all used the talking point. We don't want the smoking gun, meaning evidence. We can't afford to wait for evidence to produce itself in the form of a mushroom cloud over an American city. In other words, you can't afford to take the risk that we are lying to you. Because if we're not, you and your whole family could get nuked in your jammies in the middle of the night. And you can't have that. So trust us. We got to do this. Can you imagine? Especially looking back on that now. I mean, hell, I already knew better then, so it's not really different for me. But for those of you who bought it back then, looking back now at Iraq, can you believe that that's what they were threatening you and your family with? That Iraq was going to launch a first strike nuclear attack on the United States of America? Iraq, that had no nuclear program of any description. Remember them digging around in the garden and finding a little piece of metal and saying, look, this is for a centrifuge. Uh-huh. Buried in the dirt in the garden, huh? Left over from the 1980s when Ronald Reagan and Donald Rumsfeld were hooking up Saddam Hussein and he was working for America killing Iranians. Can you believe you bought that? We can't afford for the proof that we need to start a war to come in the form of a mushroom cloud over your city. Same as ever. They're just lying to you. They can't tell you, oh, Iran's entire nuclear program is safeguarded. It's not a weapons threat at all. It never was. We're just lying. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, Chuck Hagel's out. I don't know what's the real story for Chuck Hagel being out. I think Obama and he agreed probably last fall that they really didn't want to bomb Syria. Oops, red line thing. Yeah, let's not do the red line thing. They were pushing, but not that hard. He seems like a bit of a reluctant type. Not that he's a libertarian or a non-interventionist in any way. But the messages coming out this morning about why he got canned, a little inconsistent. One of them says that while Obama was playing down the threat from ISIS, Hagel came out and said they're a threat to everything that we know and love and care about. And so that embarrassed the president. But that makes it sound like Obama's more the hawk than Hagel. And yet, according to Bloomberg News, a big part of the problem with Hagel supposedly was he wouldn't participate in the discussions with the president and with the cabinet or the, you know, the National Security Council staff in the Oval Office. He'd have the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State and the deputies and whoever they're having a discussion, and he would just sit there. And then his version of that is, yeah, but that's because the White House staffers are a bunch of know-nothing know-it-alls who always ignore me and don't listen to me, even though I'm a veteran and I'm the Secretary of Defense and I actually know a little bit about this. They go on with their opinions anyway, so I figure, why bother arguing with them? I'll just call the president later when I get back to the Pentagon and talk with him on the phone and explain to him why everything that they think is stupid and shoot it down. Shoot down their bad ideas. That's Bloomberg News reporting that this morning. So, I don't know. Which bad ideas are they talking about? Is it that Hagel wants to escalate the war more than Obama does? You know, like the reference to that comment about him saying ISIS is such a threat after Obama had tried to play it down? The other way around. Obama's people got a bunch of great ideas about what they want to do, and he's the skeptic. And it's hard to read that the other way, like they're the skeptics and he wants to go hog wild. And for example, Hagel came out just, 2 weeks ago and said Obama needs to articulate definitively what is his strategy for Syria. That was what got him fired right there, right? Well, what is the strategy for Syria? If you look at the Islamic State for what it is, a new state, Iraq is over. Get over it. Sunnistan has declared independence from Baghdad forever. That's not going to change. Whether it's the Islamic State or whether it's a new Sunnistan ruled by the tribes or conquered by the Ottoman Turks or something, it ain't going to be Iraq no more. That's over. So you look at it as the Islamic State. Well, what do you got? You got in the east of the country, it's horrible, but at least it makes sense that America continues to back. Not now they do. I read this thing by Ryan Grimm, who's usually pretty sharp there at the Huffington Post, saying, now America's interests are aligning with Iran's. George Bush invaded Iraq for Iran, was tricked by Iran's agent Chalabi into doing it, and from the day of the invasion was fighting to install the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party in power. So get it straight. This is now 11 and a half years of fighting for Iran's position in Iraq, for the Shiite majority, for the Bada Brigade and the Mahdi army and the Asaib al-Haq and the rest of the Shiite militias. They're something, something Hezbollah, whatever they call the Shiite Iraqi Hezbollah there. And the so-called Iraqi army, which is really just the Bada Brigade. At least that fight is consistent for the last 11-something years. As horrible and completely insane and ridiculous and as covered up as that fact is. Because they just never give you the context, do they? Not usually. But then check out what's going on the western flank of the Islamic State, where America is not backing the Shiite government. They're the exact same thing. Abadi and Assad are exact clones of each other. Iranian sock puppets with, dropping barrel bombs on jihadist neighborhoods. You know, it's the exact same thing on the eastern and western front of the war against the Islamic State. And yet, in the West, America just can't decide what to do. The Israelis and the Saudis are so hell-bent on getting rid of Assad. And hey, there, at least he's not the majority. The Shiites are not the majority. It's really like a 70-something percent Sunni majority country there. The Saudis and the Israelis can't really ask the Americans to reinvade Iraq for the Sunnis and fight a whole new war, a whole new El Salvador option, and hire all the Sunnis to kick all the Shia out of Baghdad. That'll take another 10 years and another million dead to give Baghdad back to the Sunnis. So, consolation prize, give them Damascus. There's no way they're going to regime change against the Shiites in Iraq now. Do the exact opposite war of George W. Bush. They can't do that. But they're still working that policy in Syria. And even though there are leaks that say, they recognize that they've got to work with Assad for now and whatever. Hell, what the hell? Where's my, I got an article here where, who is it in Turkey? Joe Biden was in Turkey committing to the Turks for a transition in Syria. He stopped short of committing outright to regime change, but is saying, yeah, we are going, still, that's exactly what he's saying. We are going to ensure a transition away from the Assad regime, he said. So, maybe Hegel being ousted is not a matter of him being too hawkish or not hawkish enough. Maybe he was simply asking for, if he's going to be the Secretary of Defense leading America into a third Iraq war, that at least they are going to have a strategy that makes the slightest bit of sense whatsoever. This is just, it's crazy. Can you imagine being the Secretary of Defense and your job is to train up and back the Mujahideen in Syria, to fight the other Mujahideen in Syria, and to fight their greatest enemy, the Shiite government and its army? I'd quit. That's what my entire resignation speech would have been about. Well, see, ever since I took this job, Obama, the president, has been insisting I commit high treason and backing the ideological brothers and cousins of the September 11th hijackers. And it has been clear all along, it's not hyperbole to say it, the war in Syria, the civil war, has been run by the al-Nusra Front and later sharing, splitting that up with the Islamic State all along. The so-called moderates were always the slightest percentage of this thing, hardly doing any fighting at all. The entire time, the Americans are supporting the Saudi and Qatari and Turkish efforts to fund some Mujahideen there. They are, in effect, backing the worst of them. Just like Hillary Clinton said in March of 2012. Are we backing Al-Qaeda by backing so-called moderates? Yes. Still. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. You know what? Let me get back to the Middle East in a minute, but I gotta talk about the cops here, dude. This one is just pissing me off so bad. Do I have the, I gotta find my tweet here, man. I retweeted it. It's going to take me a second. But you saw the story about this 12-year-old boy who was shot by the rookie cop. Was it the rookie or was it the veteran cop that shot him? I think it was the rookie cop. Shot a 12-year-old boy with a BB gun. A black boy, 12 years old. And yeah, here it is right here, man. So, here's the eyewitness account. The eyewitness account was that he just lifted his shirt to show the cops the gun that it wasn't real. They were just sitting there on the curb when the cops pulled up. He and his friends went over to the station across the street, and a white man who was there called the police because he must have seen the gun. They came running back to the recreation center and were just sitting together when the police arrived. The police pulled their guns on the boy. His friends backed away, and he said it was just a BB gun with no bullets. That was what he said. And then he went to lift his shirt to show it to them, and they shot him twice in the stomach in front of not only his friends, but also other children. I believe his sister as well. His sister was screaming, and the police slammed her down on the ground. They actually hurt her. They were so aggressive. His brother also came on the scene and was upset, and the police slammed him to the ground as well. Meanwhile, the 12-year-old boy, this child, is shot. His mother finds out and is heard screaming through the neighborhood. All this is happening in the middle of the day yesterday at the rec center. This is written, what I'm reading here is written by his friend that was there with him. A little girl. He was a nice kid. An artist. He didn't do anything to anybody, and the cops executed him to death. So listen, you need to not only learn this, if you don't already understand, you need to teach it to people that you care about. Do not call 911. Do not call 911. They are killers. They are the Nazi Gestapo death squad. Okay? They are the death squad. They're not your friend. They're not Officer Timson from the Richard Pryor skit. They're not your protector. They're not here to help you. They are looking for the chance to kill someone. Some people, look, you know this, okay? If you're over 12 years old, then you know that some humans are murderers. Some humans would really like the chance to kill another person. Well, that's who the cops are. They are looking for the chance to kill someone. Now, when this man called 911, he must have known that. He must have known that, hey, wait a minute. Every time I turn on the TV or open up my Facebook, I see cop blows away innocent person to death. To death. Oh, well, you know what? But when I was six on Sesame Street, they sang, "These are the people in your neighborhood." And when I go home at night, I watch Dun Dun Law and Order. Where the cops aren't murderers. The cops aren't a death squad. No, they solve murders. Ha! Can you believe that? Yeah, no, on TV, the cops solve murders. And so, yeah, no, that's what I believe in. Despite everything that I know, I'm going to go ahead and go with TV, and I'm going to call 911. Then what does he do? He calls 911, and he tells the operator, this little boy, this child has a gun, but it's probably fake. It's probably fake. Well, if it's probably fake, then why did you call 911? If it's probably fake, but you think it's a problem the way he's playing with it out in public, huh? Then why didn't you go and talk to him, young man? It makes my parts quiver when you wave that BB gun around. Please put it away. Nope. He had to call the Nazi Gestapo death squad who came and executed him. A 12-year-old boy, they murdered him. They murdered him. If you murdered a 12-year-old boy because he had a BB gun, it would be murder. Well, I mean, if he was white and you were black, it would be a murder charge. Murder for murdering someone. What the hell do you mean the boy lifted his shirt and so you shot him? You are guilty of murder, murderer. The cop is guilty of murder. But you know what? So is the guy that called 911. The guy that called 911 on this little boy, he knew that Nazi Gestapo stormtroopers of death were going to be the ones to answer this call. He knows the deputy sheriffs like murdering people. He knows the city police are just itching for a chance to murder a little boy. They're dying for the chance to murder a little boy, and he knows it, and he called 911 anyway. He ought to be doing just as much prison time as the cop. And I don't mean 2 weeks paid vacation. I mean both of them, the rest of their lives in a cage. So they can think about that time that they conspired to murder a little boy. To murder a little boy. Oh, well, nah, you know, I don't know. He had black skin, and so what does that mean? That means that he has no right that a cop is bound to respect. That's what that means. That means the grand jury is already writing up the no bill. That's what that means. And you all know it. And everybody knows it. Every day the cops kill somebody. Every day they kill somebody. 100 SWAT raids a day. And it's amazing they only kill, on average, a person a day. Maybe it's more than that. But with 100 SWAT raids a day, holy crap, we're lucky it's not 100 dead people a day in this country at the hands of these thugs. It's completely out of control. And you know, I'm watching, the whole controversy is over what Giuliani said, whatever, on Fox News. And they bring on Weekly Standard guy, goes, oh yeah, way more black people are killed by other black people than are, you know, occasionally when these incidents happen where a cop kills somebody. Occasionally? You mean every single day in America. Every single day. Go and Google it your damn self. On average, every 28 hours, a black person loses their life at the hands of a white American cop. Every 28 hours. Oh no, I can't imagine why black people feel like they live, like they're Palestinians occupied by a foreign army that may or may not murder them or their children at the drop of a hat. At any moment. Mothers, keep your young black boys locked inside the house at all times. And actually, that won't protect them either. Because the cops will still come right in your door at 3 o'clock in the morning and throw grenades in your baby's face, do whatever they want. Put a bullet right through your daughter's head, like they did Daisha Jones. It's amazing. It is absolutely amazing that this continues to go on. And where's the backlash from this? And seriously, is it really as simple as a left, right, black, white divide? We're on Fox News. Come on, we all know that poor Officer Wilson was attacked by that brute. We do know that? What? Oh no, but if you're a liberal, then I guess you're by de facto, you're good on this stuff usually. But no, if you're white and you're a right-winger, you're a talk radio fan, you're supposed to automatically side with the cop who executes the unarmed black person every time. Which must be exhausting, siding with Gestapo Nazi stormtroopers of death daily. But, you know, I guess if you're into it. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show. So, yeah, they murdered this kid. Oh, man, they got the 911 call, huh? I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. Kid has a freaking BB gun, the cop murders him. I remember the first time I heard about that when I was a kid. I was probably a teenager, and I heard a cop killed a kid with a toy gun. And it was like, oh, it was foggy out or something. Like, what? Well, it wasn't a clear threat then. And everyone was shocked. This is like national news. Oh, my God. And that was when they first started then to put the orange, the telltale neon orange on the toy guns. Because, you know, cops started wasting kids with toy guns. What the hell? Somehow this was never a problem up until, I don't know, when it was, late 90s, mid 90s or something. All of a sudden, cops just start wasting kids. But can you imagine being a kid and having to have a bright orange AK-47 or whatever? That sucks. I guess I never realized how lucky I was that I never got murdered by the local sheriff's deputy for all of my toy guns. Me and my friends from second grade to fourth grade, I guess, something like that. That's all we did was play toy guns, man. We'd play Red Dawn is what we play. We had M16s. We had submachine guns too, Mac 11s with silencers. We had badass toy guns, man. You could get them at the grocery store. You get AK-47s at the grocery store. And they were awesome. And we had no idea how lucky we were that the cops didn't murder us. They didn't tell us at the checkout line at the grocery store that, you know, if you, little 10-year-old boys playing, if you have a toy gun, you are hereby forfeiting your right to your life. And the cops can now just murder you and pretend that they were afraid of you. They didn't even let me know that. It's a miracle that I'm here today. With all the toy guns I played with as a lad. BB guns. I remember one time my buddy Oscar shot a wasp in half with his BB gun. And the cops could have murdered him for that. Here, I thought it was just a good shot. Neither of us at the time, I think, understood the import that a cop could have then just come and shot him in the head. And said, oh, well, he had a BB gun. In fact, come to think of it, my friend Oscar, he grew up to be a cop. I wonder if he ever murdered any little kids for playing toy guns. I guess he probably must have, right? I wonder if he thought, there but for the grace of baby Jesus goes me, myself, dead for playing with a toy gun, murdered at the hands of a lawless, impunity possessing agent of the state. And by the way, while these guys can murder anyone they feel like, they can murder your child and absolutely skate and absolutely get away with it. You all know. We all know. We don't even have to bother. We all know that the cop that shot this little boy is going to get away with it. It's not even a question. It's not even a question whether he's going to get away with it. But meanwhile, here's a rapper who deserves to go to life in prison for having the stupidest rapper name in the history of all rapper names. Seriously. Tiny Doo. D-O-O. That's his rapper name. You know what, Brandon Duncan? I don't really feel bad about what the state does to you, you idiot. With the loserest rapper name in the history of all rap from 1975 on. You scumbag, you idiot. But anyway, check it out. The government wants to put him in prison for putting out an album. I'm not making this up. And we already know the First Amendment in America covers everything up to, but not including, come on, mob, let's cross this property line, go in there, and kill this guy. Okay? That is not protected speech. Yes, I agree. I will pay you $500 to kill that guy for me. That is not protected speech. Okay? Conspiring to kill someone or immediately leading a mob to a violent act. That is not protected speech. But anything short of that is. Brandenburg versus Ohio. Suck it. But no, these prosecutors in San Diego want to put this guy on trial for having a gangster rap album. Because they say he's a member of the Linkin Park gang. Really? Is there even a gang there? I know where Linkin Park is in L.A. It's actually not far from where I used to live in Northeast L.A. And I don't think it's named for the crappy sorrow rock band from wherever they suck. But anyway, they're saying, well, this guy's a member of a gang, and he put out an album that's going to make him money, and he's bragging about gang activity. They're not accusing him of being involved in any overt act whatsoever, other than profiting from the gang activity of others. Like he's Tony Soprano, the kingpin, and they're bringing him up on racketeering charges for putting out an album, bragging about crimes that he pretended to commit, that he didn't commit. It's just an album. It's just pretend. And they're trying to put him in prison. I'm not kidding. This is real. I'm reading it in the LA Times right now. Among the 15 suspected San Diego street gang members charged in a string of shootings is Brandon Duncan, who is not accused of providing the guns or even being present at any of the 9 different shootings, it says here. Oh, but he's got a picture of a gun on the front of his album. I couldn't make this up. Are you guys making this up? Is this some kind of disinformation campaign to try to discredit me by having me read this LA Times article on the air? Is this really a real thing? I'm sorry, I've read like 10 different reports about this. No, that's not true. 3 or 4. This is a real thing. First of all, it's a real thing that this idiot's rapper name is Tiny Dew. Are you kidding me, dude? And then, yes, they're trying to put him in prison for putting out an album. Bragging that, you know, his friend shot somebody. And they'll probably get away with it too. Because laws are made to protect agents of the state from the rest of us and to serve as excuses for agents of the state to persecute us if they feel like it. That's all it is. That's all law is. An excuse. A thin one. For example, cameras that read more than a quarter of a million license plates netted a single arrest. One stolen car they found. Meanwhile, they're tracking you everywhere you go, like they own you. It's so funny, too, because I've been calling that since 1994. Cameras everywhere. Doesn't even matter the quality of the cameras. It's all about the software. Capturing your license plate and putting it in the database and keeping track of everywhere you go forever. Everywhere you drive. And then, of course, the NSA's got all the location data of everyone who was in the car with you at the time. Everywhere you went. The rest of your life. On your permanent record. The rest of your life. Everything. Everywhere you go. And they don't destroy any of these records. It used to be a time where storage was so expensive they'd have to purge their databases every once in a while. That kind of thing. Not anymore. They're saving everything about you forever. So you don't have to have a giant, a J. Edgar Hoover style FBI file on you. All you have to do is hit enter. And everything about your life is already in the cloud. They just put your name in and hit the button, and it all comes together on the main core table of contents. Everything about your life. Good times. And then, in Seattle, the cops are going to dump the body cams. In fact, I think a judge made them because they were one of the most out-of-control police agencies in the country, or at least one that was being held to account by somebody powerful somehow. But they're complaining that, you know what it is? Too many requests. Too much data. Too many requests to fulfill for it, so we're just going to stop doing it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, why should there be accountability for the government? Who ever heard of that? Like the cop that killed Tamir Rice, who is starting his 2-week paid vacation today. He's probably in the Bahamas right now, buying cocaine on your dime. It's the Scott Horton Show, back in a few. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Now, in October 2002, Ron Paul introduced a declaration of war against Iraq in the Foreign Affairs Committee. However, and I don't know actually if this YouTube exists anymore. If I'd thought about it, I might have tried to Google it up in the break. I doubt it's... it always was really hard to find. But anyway, there was at least for a time there video from C-SPAN of Ron Paul explaining that the declaration of war, to start a war, is the responsibility of the Congress. And it is unconstitutional for the Congress to pass that responsibility to the president, to so-called authorize him to decide on the war. Because even though it's an authorization and it's Congress, what it's really doing is it's passing the responsibility off onto the president. And it works. And we can see, like Hillary Clinton said over and over again, hey, I didn't vote for war with Iraq. I voted to give Bush the authority to go to war because I thought he really needed that strong bluff so he could let the inspectors do their job. I didn't think he was going to start a war. That's the excuse. And Ron Paul, and he saw that coming, and he said, if you're going to declare war, declare war. And he introduced a declaration of war, and he made it very clear in very plain English that he would vote against it. He did not want the Foreign Affairs Committee to pass a declaration of war. He did not want the House of Representatives to pass a declaration of war. He was simply making the statement that you guys are breaking the law and you know it. You're violating the Constitution and you know it. So, I urge you all to vote with me against this resolution, but I'm calling you out. If you're really for war with Iraq, then you will vote for this and take the responsibility yourselves, he said. And then he voted against it. And Henry Hyde, who you might remember was the chair of the Judiciary Committee impeaching Bill Clinton, who deserved to be impeached for a lot of reasons, but impeached him for basically nothing, basically lying in a civil deposition. But hey, the rule of law. And so, the rule of law. And of course, it's true, if you perjured yourself in a civil deposition, especially in front of a federal grand jury, as Bill Clinton did, they would bury you under the prison. Bill Clinton would have you prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law if you perjured yourself about anything in front of a federal grand jury. So yes, it's true, he deserved to be prosecuted, you know, removed from office and prosecuted for that. But anyway, point being, pretty damn minor when it comes to things that presidents do daily. But Henry Hyde, who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, he was the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee during the run-up to the Iraq War, and he was on film, on C-SPAN, on video, telling Ron Paul, oh, we don't go by that part of the Constitution anymore, Dr. Paul. It's an anachronism. It's quaint. And so forget it. Which I didn't even realize. They never mind attempting to amend the Constitution with legislation, they can just ignore whichever parts of it they feel like. Oh, okay, thank you for explaining that in plain English, Henry Hyde. And anyway, Rand Paul is calling for, says he's going to introduce a declaration of war against the Islamic State. And he is not playing his father's game. He's not trying to call out the Congress as a bunch of hypocrites. He has every intention of voting for it, as he's made perfectly clear. He is now the leading hawk. He is now in competition with John McCain and Lindsey Graham as the leading hawk in the United States Senate. There's no other way around it. That's just a quantifiable scientific fact. Rand Paul is now as much of a hawk, at least on the Islamic State, as John McCain. I don't know what to say. I mean, what the hell? You know, he was trying to skirt this issue a little bit and write a thing saying, oh, you know, Obama, he's not doing this right. He's, what he's doing is illegal. And then saying, yeah, and, you know, I would support, you know, the authorization, gotta fight the Islamic State, which is pretty damn bad. But now he's going to introduce a declaration of war? Oh man, come on, Rand Paul. What the hell is the matter with that guy? Here it is at the Washington Times. I guess, is it top headline at antiwar.com today? Rand Paul demands Obama go to war with ISIS is the headline at the Washington Examiner. When Congress comes back into session in December, I will introduce a resolution to declare war against ISIS. I believe the president must come to Congress to begin a war and that Congress has a duty to act. Right now, this war is illegal until Congress acts pursuant to the Constitution and authorizes it. So there you go. He tries to sound all libertarian on citing the Federalist Papers, citing George Washington, citing James Madison on the war power. But what's his point? He's for the war. And in fact, you know, if they get a real declaration of war, that could mean a lot of different things for other laws here in America, could create a state of emergency here in America far beyond what we've seen so far. In a time of war, real as declared war, the law falls silent, as they like to say, which in fact is not true. If you ever read the Constitution, it doesn't say that, that everything in here is null and void in case there's a crisis. It doesn't say anything like that at all. But anyway, and then, you know, I was making fun of Rand Paul on Twitter this morning that he's coming out with this right as Chuck Hagel's leaving. Is Rand Paul pushing for the job as Secretary of Defense? Is that what he wants? To run the Pentagon for a couple of years before he runs for president? Is that what this is? Hagel can't kill people enough. Give him Ron Paul's son and he'll get the job done. Is that it? How can this be? Poor Ron. I feel so bad for him. Jesus, man. Well, it's all so unavoidable, man. This is, you know what it is right now, November 2014? It feels just like November 2002 to me. I mean, I know we're already bombing Iraq. Oh, we were already bombing Iraq then. But just getting warmed up. The real invasion comes in the spring. Yeah. And there ain't a damn thing we can do to stop it. It doesn't matter if the Washington Post already debunked the aluminum tube story 6 weeks ago. We're going to war in the spring. Full-scale invasion. Tens of thousands killed. Millions more refugees. Fighting again. Putting the Army and the Marine Corps and the CIA at the beck and call of the Ayatollah Khamenei and his Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And there ain't a damn thing I can do except just sit here in my little microphone crying. Hey, everybody, you shouldn't do this. At least back then, I could say, look at Congressman Paul getting it right. I would tell people in my cab, here, look, here's a copy of Ron Paul's speech against the Iraq War. Read it and weep. Yeah, anyway. Nothing in this world is more important than the personal ambition of Rand Paul. Is that not a fact? He's been premature ejaculating all over the place since the moment he started running for Congress. Remember when he threw his dad under the bus in 2012 at the convention and said, oh, I would be honored to be considered. Honored, that's a direct quote. I would be honored to be considered for Paul Ryan's losing spot as the VP on the Romney ticket. And I'd happily stab my own father in the back to still not even get the chance to not even be Mitt Romney's runner-up loser vice presidential goofball. Boy, was that worth it. Rand Paul, who could be the best senator in world history, instead is the worst, just because he wants to be president, and he still can't anyway. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up in just a few minutes, Patrick Hubbard's going to be here to give us the straight dope on the Iraq War. Let me say this before I say that. Help promote the show. First of all, help support the show. ScottHorton.org/support/donate. I take Bitcoins, I take PayPal, monthly subscriptions, single donations. And I need advertisers. I love advertisers. I give love to my advertisers. You want to advertise on the show? Then yeah. But also those of you who, you know, don't have a business to advertise or anything and have your day job, but you like the show, you can help support. Like the LRN commercials say, you can hit like on the social media things, you can share things. And it occurred to me when I heard another podcaster say it the other day that I could ask you to go ahead and write up reviews on iTunes if you're if you subscribe to the podcast there. Give me some stars and give me some feedback there, and then that helps with the rankings there. And if you listen to interviews that you like, hey, man, go ahead and tweet them out. Post them up on Facebook. You see one going around from Voices of Liberty, the Ron Paul thing. Maybe click share on that. And, you know, if you like, you listen to the show because you like it. So if you like it, help share it and help build up the audience a little bit. The responsibility is yours. Okay, cool. Thanks. All right, now, so let me talk about that goddamn Afghanistan. Okay, well, Obama signed secret order to expand Afghan war in 2015. U.S. troops will remain in direct combat throughout 2015, reports Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Oh, man, and I just saw the thing from Eric there about Jason, and he can do the show. Man, because, yeah, he was going to tell us about Israel. I guess we'll do it tomorrow. I didn't see the dang thing. The message from Eric here. Yeah, we got Israel stuff to talk about, Jason Ditz, on the show tomorrow. No time now. But anyway, Obama signed secret order to expand Afghan war in 2015. U.S. troops will remain in direct combat the whole time. New report coming out of the New York Times from, the other day. Despite claims the war is ending at the end of this year, they're going to keep him there. We already knew that. Back in 2012, Obama signed a deal with Karzai that said we would stay until 2024. Another 12 years. Back 2 years ago. And it's also been clear that, despite the fact that they're probably going to put Michel Flournoy in Chuck Hagel's place at the Pentagon as the Secretary of Defense, she lost the war in Afghanistan. She was the champion of the surge. She was the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy, implementing the surge and the counterinsurgency strategy of the escalation of the Afghan War, 2009 through 2011, 2012. And she failed. And so instead of being held accountable, they're going to make her the Secretary of Defense, which is funny because that's what Crystal and Kagan were saying they wanted. Not Chuck Hagel, they wanted Michel Flournoy. Back then. She's from the Center for New American Security, which is the exact same thing as this Council for the New American Century, or what is it? Oh, the Project for New American Century, just the Democrat version. And she and John Nagle and Tom Ricks, who now denies it hilariously, and the rest of these people over at the CNAS, they were the champions of the surge. They pretended the one in Iraq did anything but accomplish Osama bin Laden and the Ayatollah Khomeini's goals. And then they went on and said, let's replicate that in Afghanistan. And the deal was, as promised by the counterinsurgency crew, that we are going to clear, hold, and build Afghanistan into a brand new country. We are going to, quote, change their entire society. We are going to give them a government in a box, ready to go. We're going to put in the most technocratic technocrats to implement all our strategies. We're going to turn the American soldiers on the ground into the local Afghans' best friend while the special forces come knocking down their doors and killing them in the middle of the night. And combined with targeted high-tech special forces raids and buddy-buddy stand-around-and-get-sniped police work regular army infantry type business out there, we will win this war. And by 2011, by July 2011, we will have whooped the Taliban's ass so bad that we bring them to the table and they will negotiate on our terms. Those were the benchmarks for the Afghan surge, which failed in every way. The police forces they built up, that's the name of the Pashtun army in the south, is the police. They're a joke. They can't hold their own about the against the Taliban at all. At all. And then the Afghan army, which is the Hazaras and the Uzbeks and the Tajiks and the Northern Alliance communists, who are the quote-unquote Afghan army up there with hardly any Pashtuns included there at all. Yeah, they also can't hold their own against anything. They also are a joke of an army that at the very least depends on $1 zillion a year worth of American taxpayer money. You know, most of it created out of thin air, but still at your expense, might as well be a tax to finance the whole thing. There's no gross domestic product in Afghanistan to prop up the violent force that America has created there, which is completely dysfunctional anyway. They did not bring the Taliban to America's terms. Not in 2011, not ever. The closest thing they got to negotiating with the Taliban, they were negotiating with an imposter. You couldn't make this stuff up. The closest thing they got to negotiating with the Taliban, the guy wasn't a Taliban. He was just taking all their money. The whole thing was written up in the New York Times later. Oops, entire State Department had been had. CIA had been had for more than a year, more than half a year, 9 months or 10 months or something. They'd been negotiating with an imposter, pretending to speak for Mullah Omar, for Christ's sake. And then that was it. They just gave it up after that. They did not change the entire society. They did not give the Afghans a government in a box to take care of all of their wants and needs. McChrystal failed. Petraeus failed. Flournoy failed. That's why they have to stay forever, because they failed. Nobody denies that if you have enough tens of thousands of infantrymen backed by American money coming in, supply lines, air power, endless fleets of drones and bombs, that, yeah, Americans can camp out anywhere in the world. It doesn't mean they won the war. Just means, yes, they have enough fire to keep the Taliban at bay as long as they stay. And that, of course, is the lesson of the Iraq War, right? Even according to this General Bulger going around saying, okay, everyone, it's fine to now admit we lost the Afghan war. We lost the Iraq war. Oh, my God, heresy. In 2014, this pig admits everyone who said so all along, they were all right. And everyone who said otherwise, they were all wrong at best. Mostly were lying. No, he doesn't put it that way. But what's the lesson? You have to stay forever. That way no one can ever write a book saying you lost. You won't have to resign. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, everybody, thanks for hanging on through the break there. And now your reward. It's the great Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent in the UK. That's independent.co.uk. You can also find all he writes at uns.com. He's the author of the books Muqtada and The Jihadi's Return. Each of those about one and the other side of the sectarian war raging in what used to be called Iraq right now. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Great, great. Very happy to have you back on the show here. So the latest piece is called The Trauma of the Last 6 Months Has Overwhelmed the Remaining Christians in Iraq. Can you please tell us about the Christians of Iraq?
Well, the Christians have been in Iraq for almost 2,000 years. In 1991, there were about 1.5 million of them, mostly in Baghdad and the northern city of Mosul. They lived in, they had monasteries, they had very ancient churches. Then by 2003, they were down to 1 million. And now they're down to 250,000, and about half of those are refugees. They're living in terrible conditions. In ones I saw were living in a half-completed shopping mall in little cabins, dark little cabins that the UN High Commission for Refugees had built there. Mm. ISIS, the Islamic State, had driven them out, or they'd fled. I talked to one woman who had her baby snatched just as by somebody from the Islamic State who just she was getting on a bus. When she tried to get him back, he said he'd kill her unless she got on the bus. Another woman had to pretend, her husband had to pretend to become Muslims to protect their family, finally escaped. So this the Christian community is in Iraq is finally being destroyed. I mean, you know, there are many arguments about the invasion of 2003, but, and I guess there are winners and losers and so forth, but one group of people that sure has lost out big time is the Christians of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And now, really the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the forebears of the Islamic State, they basically had their wars against Yazidis and Christians and of different types back then. They were big parts of the refugees really since 2003, right? This is just the very culmination of it all. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, it's but it's sort of, you know, it's got a lot worse. That they, you know, these were people who were sort of forced. There was a dribble of people emigrating before to Australia, to the US, to elsewhere. But there wasn't a sort of mass onslaught on their community. Whole townships with 50,000 people in them had to cut and run. And the Yazidis, it's even worse because they're treated, you know, often there's an analogy made and people say, oh, some group of people were treated, you know, that somebody behaved like the Nazis. Well, actually, the Islamic State behaved exactly like the Nazis. They regard the Yazidis as apostates, as heretics, to be murdered, the women to be raped, to be enslaved. And that's exactly what they've done. You know, there are 400,000 people who have fled into Kurdistan, again, living in pretty terrible conditions.
Hmm. Well, and now speaking of that, you reported back a few months ago when Mosul first fell and the Islamic State really came roaring back into Iraq the way that they did, that some of your sources talked about how they had done a census in the neighborhood of how old is everybody's daughter because we might just want to marry her and this kind of thing. And so I don't think anybody who remembers the last war can hear stuff like that without immediately thinking of the awakening movement when the local Iraqis said that, you know, despite all of y'all's talk about Islam being your mandate and everything, this is our country, not yours. And we will not take orders from the likes of you and turn on them. Of course, everybody in the American media likes to give Petraeus all the credit for all of that. But what had happened was the Iraqi population had just turned on them. And so I know that you've talked a lot about this and the relative power between ISIS now compared to Al-Qaeda in Iraq back in 06. But, I mean, just how tenable or just how maybe the other way, how solid is the Islamic State's power when they are such brutes, as you say, that they cannot help but make everyone hate their guts everywhere that they go?
Well, I think it's more solid than it looks, unfortunately. One, because, you know, terror works. There are lots of people in Mosul who are unhappy. I mean, the big northern city with 2 million people in it who are unhappy at women being forced to wear the niqab and be entirely covered in this sort of black cloak, who don't like the way ISIS blew up some of their mosques, famous shrines, and persecuted the Christians and so forth. There isn't much, you know, unhappiness is different from action, and it's not clear what action they could take. Mosul was occupied by the Iraqi government. Most of the weapons were taken. And this is a well-organized, very suspicious, very violent movement. So even if they are unhappy, I don't think there's much they can do about it.
So I'm sorry to put it this way. I know it's kind of silly, but if you could quantify it on a scale of power 1 to 10, could you put Al-Qaeda in Iraq as of 2006 versus the Islamic State now, you know, some kind of relative?
Oh, yeah, I think there's Islamic Al-Qaeda in Iraq maybe between 2 and 3 for a brief period, but not for very long. The Islamic State, you know, rules an area, is in total control of an area the size of Great Britain in Iraq and Syria. It's about 250,000 square kilometers. Mm. That's a very big area, and they've held most of that since June, and they aren't losing it. So, you know, they've been bombed, they suffer some losses, but they can probably afford to suffer some losses. So these guys are not imploding, they're not even really retreating. Hmm. So, you know, 6 months there, you know, their battle slogan is the Islamic State will remain, the Islamic State will expand. And they're kind of doing it. You know, they're not at the pace, there's a bit of a stalemate, they've suffered some losses. But unfortunately, they're not really on the back foot yet. So, you know, there isn't much locals can do about it. They have their own sort of intelligence service that they seek out potential opponents and kill them or jail them or torture them or whatever. So I can't see them going down. And their opponents are still very divided. You know, the U.S. is having its airstrikes, but and was compelled at the last moment to ally to support the Syrian Kurds, who are fighting the Islamic State at Kobani. But at the same time, the U.S. hasn't really made up its mind to unite or even cooperate with other people who are fighting the Islamic State, such as the Syrian army or the Shia militias or other things. So American policy remains very ambivalent and consequently pretty ineffective.
Mm. All right. Now, so one of your recent articles talks about the number of fighters there. The CIA says that, well, maybe they got about 3,500 or 35,000 fighters, 30,000, something like that. I talked with Mitchell Prothero about that, and he started ticking off places where the Islamic State has a fight going on and are holding their own in Anbar, up in just kind of to the south and east, almost near the Iranian border there. As you mentioned, Kobani, still they're holding down Fallujah and Mosul. So I don't think he had like a real number to guess, but he was saying it's certainly better than 30,000. This Kurdish leader, as you report here. Everybody listening live, we'll be right back. I'm going to go ahead and continue interviewing Patrick through the break here for the archive, because what are you going to do? But we'll be right back. But so I wonder, you know, kind of back of the envelope math there, how many guys do you think they have? How many fighters do you think they have now? And I don't know exactly how you separate, you know, their core from their new recruits or those kinds of things, but I guess I'll let you.
Yeah, I mean, this was an interview I did with Fuad Hussein, who's the chief of staff of President Masoud Barzani, the leader of the Kurdistan Regional Government, which is effectively pretty well an independent state. And he was saying, you know, it's really absurd to think that they can be attacking, the Islamic State can be attacking all over the place in northern Iraq, around Baghdad, in northern Syria and western Syria, unless they number in the hundreds of thousands. Now, some of these will be local people, you know, that they've recruited. When you have an area that big, you can recruit local people, local young men. And this is an area where there are no jobs, so a lot of local young men will want some sort of job. They pay about $400 a month. Not a lot, but better than nothing. And on top of that, there are a lot of people who will be inspired by their vision, by their ideology. So, Fuad Hussein estimate there were about 10, 12 million people ruled by the Islamic State. I think it's considerably less than that, but let's say it's 6 or 7 million. They can still recruit a lot of people. And there's no doubt that they are. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who've had recent contact with the Islamic State around Mosul. And, you know, I said, you know, do you meet any foreigners? And they said, no, they're all Iraqis. So I think they're recruiting a lot of people. And so I think that 30,000, I don't know where this figure comes from, where the CIA got it from. But I think that it's far greater than that. It's over 100,000. And probably, you know, in these villages, all the young men have arms. At a certain point, you can mobilize them. So then we're up to, you know, well into the hundreds of thousands.
Wow. So now, obviously, you're saying you think they have the power to hold the territory they've got for now. What about further expansion, or have they already basically hit the limits of their outer borders?
It's more difficult in Iraq because now they're moving into Kurdish territory, moving into Shia territory. They come out of the Sunni community. Also, that to a degree, Baghdad and the Kurds have—I won't say they've got their act together—but they aren't running away in the way they did previously. You've got the Shia militias that were very sectarian, very violent around Baghdad, but they're pretty powerful. You've got them aided by American airstrikes. The Kurds are organizing. So they're facing greater opposition. And in Syria, of course, they failed to take Kobani. But even so, you know, their opponents are very divided. You know, that you suddenly hear on CNN that the U.S. the White House has decided that, you know, Assad has to go before anything is to be done in Syria. But, you know, Assad's army is the main opponent of the Islamic State. Assad goes, this is a big plus for the Islamic State. So I think the administration hasn't really thought through how it's going to fight this war if it wants to win it.
Yeah, it's all domestic politics obviously are calling those shots, because on the face of it, that's crazy. That's like saying if France wanted to intervene against the South in the American Civil War, that they would have had to regime change Abraham Lincoln first before they can go attack the South. That doesn't make any sense at all.
No. Exactly. I mean, it's sort of kind of weird, you know, I suppose. I mean, I see that, you know, Defense Secretary Hagel is just gone today in Washington. But hasn't come across to me. Maybe it's known to you, you know, exactly why he's gone. Because the policy he seemed to be advocating seemed to be that of the White House. Maybe it's a general sense of frustration that things are going wrong.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, one of the leaks in Bloomberg News today says that he was tired of arguing with the White House staff that didn't really know anything or have any experience, and so he didn't really speak in the meetings. He would just call the president when he got back to his own office and then go through and debunk everything that they had said. And I guess my understanding is that he had been against bombing Assad. He and Dempsey and Obama had really all three not really wanted to follow through on bombing Assad back a year and a couple of months ago, August, September 2013, that he'd been hesitant there. And as we're talking about the policy of attacking Assad now or doing anything, as Biden was just saying to Erdogan the other day, 2 days ago, that we're going to continue to work on this transition against Assad. It's absolutely insane or completely nonsensical anyway. So it's easy to imagine that that's what this is about, is somebody is having trouble digesting the fact that we're backing the Shia side of the sectarian war in Iraq, but we're still backing the Sunni side of the sectarian war in Syria.
Yeah, you know, it's a fantastic mess. And, you know, they're bombing the Islamic State, but that's not defeating them. You know, that it's sort of, in fact, you know, it probably means that in their areas, the other jihadis will rally to the Islamic State. So I think that, maybe Hegel is carrying the can for a general sort of failure to devise and implement a feasible policy towards the Islamic State. I mean, I think they're going to sort of fight it or they're not. Mm. And I think that they've done a bit, but, not very much.
All right. Now, earlier this year, I believe it was early in the spring, you went and actually interviewed Muqtada al-Sadr, the subject of your previous book. He complained about all the sectarianism, and he, if I remember right, he kind of pointed the finger at Maliki for doing his part and making sectarianism worse. And the way I remember it, even though he did take part in the Civil War in 06 and 07, he also was always much more nationalist and anti-Iranian and anti-American than the other Shiite leaders. And I wonder what you think, you know, how you measure his position in all this. Is the Mahdi army just another auxiliary of Iran at this point, like the Badr Brigade? Or is there a possibility of some actual reconciliation here if somebody like Sadr was to take the lead?
I think it's difficult to do. I mean, I think he has a rather guilty conscience over what happened in 2006-07, that his sort of Mahdi army, his militia, became a purely sectarian force, a Shia force that was killing Sunnis. At the same time, the Shia are coming under intense pressure from the Islamic State. There have been lots of car bombs and suicide bombs in Shia areas. So you need some sort of defense force. I mean, his feeling about foreign opposition, I mean, he told me foreign intervention is, he said, you know, the problem about Iraq, is, you know, that you have a domestic problem and you call in one bunch of foreigners and then they come in and then you want to sort of get rid of them. So you call in some other foreigners, you know, and it all gets worse. And you know, his analogy was, you know, that you got a mouse in the house, you call in a cat, you know, and you get fed up with the cat and you call in a dog and finally you end up with an elephant and in the house. And, you know, then, you know, things just get worse and worse. So he's against foreign intervention. The problem is that the situation is so sectarianized in Iraq now that, you know, when you talk, I was talking to in the north to Christians, to Yazidis, all these people feel that when the Islamic State came, that their Sunni neighbors collaborated with them and took their houses and took their cars and money and so forth. Now, this may be just the kind of hysteria you have when people have been driven out from their land, but it's believed. So it's very difficult to think that you could ever have mixed areas in Iraq again. The degree of ethnic and sectarian hatred is really very great now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's funny to hear, you know, I actually read Andrew Bacevich saying that it is, you know, basically gospel in Washington, D.C., that there's such a thing as Iraq and that this is a fight between, just like Donald Rumsfeld days, this is a fight between the Iraqi people and the terrorists. In fact, Matthew Ho, who was a Defense Department and then a State Department official, told me on the show a couple of weeks ago that back in 2006, he was in some of these highest level meetings where it was just absolutely verboten for anyone to even acknowledge the truth that we're fighting on the side of the Badr Brigade against the Sunni-based militia, that this is a sectarian thing, the Sunni insurgency, I meant to say, that no, the narrative inside the highest level meetings was the same as the one on Fox News, that we're fighting for the Iraqi people and its democracy against the terrorists. And apparently, according to Bacevich, this is exactly the thinking that's going on in D.C. right now. So the conversation that we're having, they're not even having this on the National Security Council. They're not even being honest with each other about who's who and who's on whose side and what it all even means. So no wonder they can't come to a policy if they can't get beyond their own talking points, even at the highest councils of discussion.
Yeah, I think it's so, you know, that they said, well, you know, we want a more inclusive government in Baghdad, which includes the Sunnis. And then we sort of have a new government, but it really doesn't make much difference. You know, it's still very much Shia. It's still very corrupt. You know, the thing to remember about the whole Iraqi sort of political military machine is that no officer in the Iraqi army ever gets a job without paying for it. He pays for it because you make money out of it, you know, through kickbacks from soldiers who get a salary but never go near the barracks, or you have salaries for soldiers that don't really exist, and of course you get money for food for paying for non-existent soldiers. All that kind of stuff means that, you know, the people hold these jobs in the army, whether a colonel or a captain or a major or a general, in order to make money. They don't do it to fight. And that was true 6 months ago, and so far as I know, it's still true now.
All right, now, but what are the reports of the progress, at least of the special forces teams and so forth, at the Baiji oil refinery? They finally have broken that siege, is that right?
Yeah, there are some units that will fight, you know, and you can do some things, but probably not enough, you know. They're sort of backed by the Sunni militias and by the Shia militias, I meant to say. So I think it's very difficult to rebuild the army or rebuild a state, a government, which is really a kleptocracy. Mm-hmm. You can try, you might have some successes, but I think that it's probably going to be pretty limited.
All right, now, I'm sorry, I don't have the map in front of me, but I think I'm right that the Baiji refinery is north of Tikrit, right? So if the so-called Iraqi army and their militias and whatever have control of that land, does that mean that if they can't outright invade Tikrit, that they can besiege it and drive the Islamic State out of it at some point there?
Yeah, there's not many people left in Tikrit, you know, mostly because of the bombing and so forth. Most people have fled. The Islamic State might fight for it. They might not. They're not in a great position there because they've got the Iraqi army before, in front and behind them. They've moved some of their forces out of there. That's a part of Iraq is, I guess, predominantly Sunni, but there are some big Shia towns as well. And the Kurds are just to the north in Kirkuk. So, you know, they might have some successes there. On the other hand, you know, this type of war, you have to wait a bit longer because the Islamic State, you know, is fighting hard in Anbar and having successes there, but doesn't seem to have moved its forces out of around Tikrit. You know, it often, in this type of sort of semi-guerrilla warfare, it often looks as though one side is winning, but it isn't. It's just the other side hasn't decided to fight at this moment, and they're going to fight later.
Right. Yeah, fight where it's easiest. Well, what about Kirkuk? Because I know the Kurds want it. I don't know what the percentage is now, ethnicity-wise, between Kurds and Arabs. And I guess there's no more Iraqi army there. But can the Kurdish Peshmerga keep the Islamic State out of Kirkuk for the long haul, you think?
I think so, yes, because it matters a lot to them. That's where the oil fields are. I think they'll fight very hard for Kirkuk, and they'll probably hold it. But it'll mean a lot of fighting because to the south and to the west, the Islamic State, has a lot of strength in some very tough Sunni areas. So I think you'll have this sort of sectarian ethnic war going on, one thing that's happening, which is pretty ominous in Iraq and Syria, but particularly in Iraq, that because both sides are so terrified of each other that you have these long, sort of battle lines. Each side, if they concentrate their forces, can punch through. But the civilian population on the other side is so terrified these days that it immediately, takes to its heels. So you have lots of Kurdish refugees who've, fled from around Mosul. You have Yazidis, you have Christians, but you also have Sunni Arabs from Anbar, who've kind of got nowhere to go because they can't go into Kurdistan because the Kurds hate them, and they can't go into Shia areas because of a similar region. So Iraq is turning into another Syria in terms of a big chunk of the population having become refugees or internally displaced people, as the aid agencies call them, and that sort of desperate nomadic population of people who have fled their homes but don't have anywhere to go is growing by the day.
All right. Well, with that, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time again on the show, Patrick. Great one.
Oh, thank you very much, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is the heroic Patrick Coburn. He's the author of The Jihadi's Return. Brand new out. Find it at orbooks.com. That's orbooks.com. And before that, the book was Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Future of Iraq. And find all of his archives at independent.co.uk and at unz.com, U-N-Z, unz.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.